And the people who are dissenting now are not dangers to the nation. The President of the United States is a danger to the nation. The President of the United States is taking actions which are going to make us more vulnerable and more insecure than we ever were, and all under the guise of making us more secure, and all under the guise of a war against terrorism.
From the studios of Freak Radio 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, it's time for the Weekly Freak Show. My name's the V-Man, and I'll be your host for this one-hour examination of the news and events not hard in or glanced over by the corporate-controlled media. On this week's program, we'll hear a talk given by Howard Zinn, celebrated author and historian. His classic, A People's History of the United States, has sold more than 900,000 copies and is widely used in colleges and university classrooms. Howard Zinn spoke in Santa Cruz on November 14th for the 25th anniversary of the Resource Center for Nonviolence. Plus, this week's Spotlight Sound. Stand by for the Weekly Freak Show, coming up next. Howard Zinn is a man of multiple passions and gifts, and hard to nail down. He is a professor, a poet, a journalist, a stand-up comic, a celebrity magnate, a skeptic, an optimist, a gadfly, and a mensch. He is one of the country's most beloved and respected historians, and author of numerous books and plays, and a passionate activist for radical change. His classic, A People's History of the United States, has sold more than 900,000 copies and is used widely in colleges and universities. Whether his subject is war, race, politics, economic justice, or history itself, Zinn speaks and writes with clarity and humor. His recent books include You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train, A Personal History of Our Times, The Zinn Reader, and a play, Marx in Soho. He appeared at the Civic Auditorium in Santa Cruz, California, on the evening of November 14th, where he spoke to more than 1,200 people. We'll now hear his talk. Howard Zinn.
You know, the first thing I notice about what's going on today is this notion of a united nation, right? A nation united behind Bush. I mean, if I'm going to be united... I want to choose with whom I'm united, you see. And I'm very distressed by, uneasy, I'm trying to find the right word, by this chorus of, you know, unity, we must stand behind the president. Dan Rather, you know who he is, right? Everybody knows who, you know, people may not know who the president is, but they know who Dan Rather is. You see, Dan Rather is an anchor man, right? What is he anchored to? You say, you know, no, he is anchored to the establishment. That's the definition of an anchor person. And then he said very shortly after September 11th, Bush is my president, which was good to know. And he said, when he says get in line, I get in line. And I thought, really? This is independent journalism. You know, this is the job of a journalist to get in line when the president says get in line. I mean, that's what journalists do in a totalitarian state. That's not what you do in a democracy. In a democracy, the job of journalism is to be a watchdog of the government and to stand aside and criticize and examine what the government does, you know. And then Gore, remember? Remember? Try to remember who he is. Gore. Gore said, Bush is my commander-in-chief. And I thought, he hasn't read the Constitution. The Constitution says that the president is the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. He's not the commander-in-chief of us, you see. He's not, you know. He's, you know. So, that, you know, there's this cry for unity. I spoke a few weeks ago at Johns Hopkins, arranged by Speak Out, which also arranged this. Do you know about Speak Out? Speak Out, an amazing, amazing group of people, very mysterious. They're there somewhere in the San Francisco area, and they do amazing things. They bring speakers to campuses, speakers that otherwise would invite Oliver North. I mention him because when I spoke at Johns Hopkins, there was a series, and I was preceded by Oliver North. And the theme of the series of lectures, which had been arranged before September 11th, the theme was, because it was about multiculturalism. You know, Oliver North knows a lot about multiculturalism. And the theme was multiculturalism. And so the headline for the series of lectures was A Nation Divided. Well, by the time I got to speak at Johns Hopkins, September 11th had happened. And I saw that they had crossed out by hand on every single printed program the word divided and put in the word united. So I had something to talk about. I mean, you know, sometimes we get up here, we don't know what to talk about. But life presents something to us, and so we have something to talk about. So yes, our job is to do what the journalists won't do and what the politicians won't do, and that is to stand aside from this artificial entity called the government and to examine what it does and to speak truth about what is right and what is wrong, even if the polls say that 90%, you know all of that. I don't really believe that 90%, except in the most superficial sense, except in the sense that, you know, somebody has thrust a microphone in front of somebody. Do you support the president? Well, of course. But those same people, if you talk to them for 3 minutes, if you make 3 points to them and ask 2 questions, I've seen this again and again, and maybe you have too. People think about it. People have second thoughts. And at first, sort of Pavlovian reaction to, yes, we support the president, begins to change. Yeah, when you begin to just give a little bit of information and ask a few probing questions. So I'm very encouraged by going around the country and seeing, not just in Santa Cruz, you know, you might say, oh, Santa Cruz, well, no. Not just everywhere, you know, large numbers of people are gathering all over the country, and they do not get in line with the president on the matter of going to war in Afghanistan, you see. And if you don't know history, it's as if you were born yesterday. If you were born yesterday, you may believe anything that somebody in authority tells you, because you have no way of checking up on it. But if you know some history, you will know that when the president gets up before the microphone and says, something has happened, we must go to war, and you think of all the times in the past where a president has gotten up before a microphone and said, we must go to war, and think of all the times after that war when people stood up and looked around and said, what in the world have we done, you say. If you knew that history, no, you wouldn't immediately get in line. I mean, we're accustomed to Congress getting in line. I mean, there's a history there, too. The history is that when the president decides, or when somebody around him decides, there are people, you know, there are people around the president. The president is not a lonely man. There are people, there are very powerful people around the president. Around the president, above the president, inside the president. Historically, this is true. You know, you go back to the Mexican War of 1846, when Polk decides to go to war, Congress, just with virtually no debate, yeah, absolutely. But the troops who go down to Mexico to fight in that war look around after a while and they see the corpses on the battlefield and they think, what are we doing here? And so on the way to Mexico City, 7 of the 13 regiments that General Scott is marching to Mexico City go away, desert, go back home. And this happens again and again. Congress says, yes, yes, let's go to war. And then later on, other things happen, and people examine what went on. And we've had too many instances now of where Congress has immediately given its assent to a war without thinking. I mean, these are people supposed to think a little, right? I mean, these are our representatives. Well, they're really not our representatives. But, you know, we go to junior high school and we learn that there's, you know, a system of checks and balances. Do you remember that? Do you remember? How can you not remember that beautiful moment in junior high school, you know, when the teacher put on the board checks and balances and then drew the diagrams. Here's the executive, here's the legislative, here's the judicial, and here are the lines going back and forth. And I remember sitting there in awe, you know. Wow, this is wonderful. If one branch of government does something bad, it will be checked by another branch of government. And in that way, nothing bad can happen, you see. But when it comes to war, there are no checks and balances. When it comes to war, Congress reacts like a bunch of sheep. And we've seen this. Well, of course, we just saw what happened, right? We just saw that, you know. Bush says war, and unanimously in the House, and almost except for Barbara Lee. Right, right. Yeah. You know, unanimously in the Senate. I mean, you know, this is a system that acts this way is a corrupt political system, a system where you can't depend on your representatives to examine what the president does and decide whether he deserves a blank check to go to war. A system like that is a deeply flawed, even sick system, and needs to be drastically changed. And so we have to, and the same thing happened in the 1964, right, at the start of the Vietnam War, right, where the president gets up before the microphone. We have been attacked in the Gulf of Tonkin. Nobody knows where the Gulf of Tonkin is, you see. But, you know, I'm sure there are people who thought it was off the coast of San Francisco. No, it's halfway around the world. It's off the coast of Vietnam. Well, it turns out that all that stuff that was told about Tonkin turned out to be lies. I mean, can you utter one sentence with four lies? Yes, you can if you're a leader of the government. And lies were told about that. Nevertheless, Congress, remember, immediately, unanimously in the House, almost unanimously in the Senate, Morse, Gruning, two senators, said no. But that's what, so much for checks and balances. I go into that because I want us to understand that we cannot depend on our political system to save us from the decisions made up there in the White House by whoever is there in and out of the Lincoln bedroom. We cannot depend on that. Well, we've learned that lesson again and again in history, that we cannot depend on the political structure to save us and to solve the problems. When people say to you, and, you know, this has been said so often lately, been said by, you know, presumably intelligent people and journalists and editors and columnists, and, you know, that, you know, this is no time to dissent, right? We're at war. It's a very interesting process. You know, if you don't want any dissent, go to war. I mean, that's quickly, you know. And it's okay to have free speech, but not in time of war. In other words, exactly when you need it, exactly when it's a matter of life and death. You know, it goes back to World War I, where, you know, the Supreme Court rewrote the First Amendment. The First Amendment says Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. And in 1917, with the United States going to war in Europe, Congress passed a law abridging the freedom of speech. And, of course, if you would draw upon your junior high school knowledge and say, well, now the Supreme Court will declare this unconstitutional, because we learned that's the job of the Supreme Court. But when the case came up before the Supreme Court of this guy handing out leaflets on the streets of New York, criticizing the war, criticizing the draft, and he has the audacity to claim that the First Amendment protects him, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. Well, he hasn't reckoned with the astute reasoning of members of the Supreme Court. I mean, why do you go to law school? I mean, to figure the, you know, to know how to make two equal four. And so, this, you know, the Supreme Court, headed by a supposed liberal, Oliver Wendell Holmes, you know, very well-educated, well, education, very well-educated man, you see. And he sort of amends the First Amendment and say, well, not if there's a clear and present danger, which sort of on the surface sort of makes, you know, sounds reasonable until you think, ah, this guy distributing leaflets on the streets of New York is a clear and present danger to the nation. No, Woodrow Wilson, the president, is a clear and present danger to the nation. You know. And the people who are dissenting now are not dangers to the nation. The president of the United States is a danger to the nation. The president of the United States is taking actions which are going to make us more vulnerable and more insecure than we ever were, and all under the guise of making us more secure, and all under the guise of a war against terrorism. I must tell you this, when I saw the images on television, I think all of you did, no, really horrible images of what happened on September 11th, yes, an atrocity, yes, an act of terrorism. And you see the people racing through the streets with the dust on their faces and the panic and the buildings collapsing and the fires and the people leaping out of windows. And yes, it's a horror. And then as I watched this, and after getting over the initial shock of this, I thought, this is what it must have been like when I was dropping bombs in Europe. This is what the scenes must have been like down below, which I couldn't see because you bomb from 30,000 feet, you don't see anybody. Now we have B-52s bombing from 40,000 feet. Bomb from 30,000 feet, you don't see any people, no human beings. You don't hear screams, you don't see blood, you don't see dismembered limbs, you don't see any of that. And yet that's what must have been going on. And then I thought, how many scenes like this have taken place all over the world that we have not been as sensitive to as we have been with regard to what happened in New York? And what does that mean? That things like this happen to people all over the world. Things happen in, yes, scenes like this multiplied many times in Vietnam. Scenes like this during the Korean War when we started using napalm in large quantities. Scenes like this in East Timor with the Indonesian army massacring huge numbers of people with American arms. Scenes of horror, which we did not see on our television screen and which did not come across to us with the same impact, with the same vividness that what happened in New York did. And I thought, if we learn anything from this event, and we should learn something from it, it's taken place, we can't undo it. These people have died and a terrible thing happened. But if we don't learn anything from it, then it's going to happen again and again and again. And what we have to learn from it is that we must become aware, you know, that terrorism, the indiscriminate killing of innocent people, is something that has been going on for a long time all over the world, is still going on, that in many cases the United States has been responsible for that. And if we don't learn that, if we don't understand that, then we will continue carrying out the kind of policies that make terrorism inevitable. You know, that's something to think about. So when I talk to people, I mean, all of us have had this experience, right? Even in Santa Cruz, there are people who believe in the war, right? I'm sure. You know, we haven't let them in tonight. But they're there, yes. No, but everybody, all of us have had the experience of talking to people who believe honestly and sincerely, you know, yeah, this is the right thing to do. I mean, and the reasons given are varied. I mean, sometimes the reasons given are, well, we've got to do something. It's an interesting way of thinking. Got to do something. So you bomb. Is it possible that there are other things that you could do? I think it's important to talk to people on the basis of what they really want to what they care about, what they want to accomplish. And clearly people are stricken by what happened on September 11th, and they want to do something about it. And the first thing they want to do is catch the perpetrators. Well, it seems a reasonable thing. When crime is committed, you catch the perpetrators. Okay, let's go after the perpetrators. But when somebody commits a criminal act or a murder in a city, and you know they're hiding out in this neighborhood, you don't bomb the neighborhood, you know. I mean, that's essentially what we're doing, you know. And so from a pragmatic point of view, is will this work? You want to catch Osama bin Laden? We don't know where he is, but we're going to bomb. Maybe we'll get lucky, you know. Maybe, you know, who knows? Lots of other people will get killed, you know. But maybe in the course of it, he, right? But okay, what comes next? What if you get Osama bin Laden? What if you capture him? What if you kill him? Is that an end to terrorism? When people think about it for a while, it doesn't take long to think about it. No, they know that's not going to bring an end to terrorism. In fact, our own government has said, you know, and what our government says depends on what time of the day and what day of the week it is, because you hear all conflicting reports, you know, from, you know, but one of the things they say is, well, you know, there are terrorist cells in 30 countries. Or sometimes they say 50 countries. Or sometimes, well, you know, they just pick a number out of the, you know. But the point is that terrorist cells, so what are you going to do? You're going to bomb all those countries. If there are terrorist cells in all these countries, then what's the point? What if you get Osama bin Laden? Oh, but did you notice the goal has changed, I think, as people began to realize. In fact, at one point, I think, Rumsfeld said, we may never get Osama bin Laden. You know, there are brief seconds of candor that come from, and you have to watch very carefully because, you know, we won't get Osama bin Laden. We'll destroy the Taliban. Well, okay, Taliban is bad, very bad. And so what if you destroy the Taliban? What then? Have you then gotten rid of terrorism? If you don't know where terrorism comes from, and if it comes from many, many different places, and in fact, it's not even clear what the relationship between the terrorism and Afghanistan are, except that it's said that Osama bin Laden and members of Al-Qaeda are hiding there, but there also others are hiding, you know, everywhere else, you know. So what are you going to accomplish by this? So from a pragmatic point of view, just from the point of accomplishing your objective, you know, of doing something about terrorism, most people on reflection will see, no, that doesn't do it. It's more complex than that. Terrorism is a very complicated situation with many, many different sources of it. And if you're engaged in an operation where you don't know what you are going to accomplish, and the chance of accomplishing what you want to do is very, very slim, then why in the process are you killing people? By the way, the business of killing people, the business of civilian casualties, have been glossed over in the press. You would have to read the press carefully. That is, you would have to read, you know, pick out a clipping here and pick out a paragraph here and pick out a news story there and put it all together in order to understand the havoc that we have created in Afghanistan. It can't be, this is not a limited military operation. Now, we don't know how many civilian casualties are, but there have been dispatches from the Associated Press and from Reuters and from Agence France-Presse and, you know, more from foreign newspapers than here in the States, but, you know, they're right across the border in Pakistan, and they've talked to people who have fled Afghanistan into Pakistan, and the people who have fled across the border are wounded, and their children with bloody bandages, and they're looking for help, and they're saying how whole families have been destroyed and a village has been bombed. And you know Red Cross was bombed twice. And we don't know how many people, we don't know what the casualties are, we don't know what the figures are. The Taliban lies, our government lies, right? This is a basic rule of politics. Governments lie. All of them, really. But you have to surmise, and then you think, oh, well, It isn't a huge amount of casualties. Well, we don't know. 100, 200, it's not clear. Yeah, I mean, compare that to the, you know, number of people who died in a terrorist act in New York. It's just, but it's not just the people who've died under our bombs. It's the fact that our bombs have caused hundreds of thousands of Afghans to leave their homes, really, to empty the cities and to flee somewhere out for safety because the bombs were falling around them and their kids couldn't sleep at night and they were frightened. We have been terrorizing the people of Afghanistan with the claim that we're doing something about terrorism. There's something really absurd about that, you know. And don't let anybody talk about we're only aiming at military targets. I mean, you have to know a little history of bombing in order to know how false that claim is. Oh, it's, you may be aiming at a military target. When I was a bombardier, and they told us, oh, wow, you can drop a bomb in a pickle barrel from where you have this special. There's always some new special device which they make big claims for, you know. And we have the Norden bomb site, a super secret bomb site. In fact, we're going to give you a pistol to carry with you in case you're shot down. So first thing you do with the pistol, you shoot the bomb site so that they won't get it. You say, oh, great. I could imagine myself doing that, a mercy killing. And so with this great, terrific bomb site, you bomb it. You can get it in a pickle barrel when you bomb it 4,000 feet. You bomb it 11,000 feet, oh, then it's a couple of hundred yards away. You bomb it 30,000 feet, and you're lucky to get within a quarter of a mile or half a mile. The whole idea of just bombing military targets, no. Aside from the fact that what the United States government defines as military targets is always interesting. In the war against Iraq, water systems were defined as military targets. Electrical systems were defined as military targets. And therefore, the infrastructure of Iraq was destroyed, leaving hospitals without water and people on hospital beds without the basic necessities that they needed, and all of this presumably military targets. And that's leaving aside the fact that the momentum of war leads the bombing nation to run out quickly of military targets and to hit all sorts of things. In Vietnam, we destroyed and bombed villages. Remember, going back to World War II, just to give an indication of how loosely this notion of military targets is presented to the public, I don't know if you know this, but when the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, President Truman said that the bomb was dropped on a military target in order to avoid, as far as possible, the killing of civilians. Really, he said that. They haven't publicized that very much. I was in North Vietnam during the war, and I saw villages as far as you can get from any possible military target, villages over which jet bombers had come night after night to bomb these villages. And there were the fresh dug graves of kids all around the village. I mean, the nature of modern warfare, the nature of bombing is such that to talk about a just war in the technological conditions of modern warfare is really absurd. And, you know, there's always a good cause that is presented. You know, oh, well, you know, we've got to stop this, we've got to do this, got to prevent this, got to do something about this tyrant, about this border crossing, and so on. But it doesn't matter what the initial, presumably good cause is. As soon as you go into war, the goodness disappears and the evil means take over. And as a result, we have to simply be against war, period. Because in the wars of our time, the evil of the means is certain. The goodness of the end is always uncertain. And when you're faced with that situation, the moral conclusion is very clear. And that obtains in a situation that, you know, that we are in today.
let it go. I'm going to steady, steady, steady one no more. I'm going to think the one no more. I'm going to fight the one no more. We're giving it up, we're going to let it go. We're giving it up, we're going to let it go. We'll take them powder to have fun. Then get rid of the atom bomb. Something else that we can do. We'll get rid of all of those rockets.
From the studios of Freak Radio 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, you're tuned to the Weekly Freak Show on Micro Power 102.9 FM, community radio for Dade City, Florida. Please have a pen and paper ready to take down our contact information at the end of this one-hour broadcast. That was Willie Dixon with this week's Spotlight Sound, Study War No More. And now back to Howard Zinn.
So when people try to explain why we are bombing, I think it's very important to bring across to them what we are doing to the people of Afghanistan, because if people have the idea, we're not really doing very much. You know, it's not a terrible thing. It's, you know, a small number. No, they have to know vividly and clearly what we are doing to the people of this country, which has gone through 20 years of mayhem and war and starvation. And the idea of this great superpower with all of its military apparatus raining bombs on this already much, much bombed and starving country, there's something really horrifyingly immoral about that. So from a pragmatic point of view, it doesn't work. and from a moral point of view, you know, it's impermissible. And sure, you can catch Osama bin Laden. Sure, you can, you know, and I know there are the people, you know, progressive people want to give an answer to we must do something. So they say, well, we'll set up an international investigative team and use all sorts of intelligence methods and, you know, the way the police do, and you find informers and you bribe people and you, you know, and maybe we'll find them. Okay, go ahead. But know that that's not going to solve the problem, you know. Sure, you can take security measures, you know, airports. You can try to make, you know, Santa Cruz a secure city. Ultimately, you know, it's the nature of terrorism to be able to get around all of the devices that people set up for security, although you do as much as you can. And so ultimately, you really are left with the fact that you must try to analyze intelligently what is at the root of terrorism and figure out what to do about it. And when you do that, it then becomes clear at the root of all terrorism is some grievance. And the grievance is not just held by the terrorists, because it's not that you want to please the terrorists and satisfy their grievance. The grievance held by the terrorists is a grievance also held by millions of other people. When you find out that Osama bin Laden is furious over the fact that the United States has stationed 35,000 troops in his home of Saudi Arabia, it's not just him that you are infuriating, but you are infuriating huge numbers of people in the Middle East, in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere, who don't like the idea of American troops in the land of their holy places. And so, you know, beneath the terrorism of the IRA were genuine grievances, but beneath the terrorism of the Palestinian car bombers, genuine grievances. Beneath the terrorism of the Basques, genuine grievances. And those grievances cannot be solved by force. That they used that again and again and again in Ireland, and it didn't work. They've used it again and again and again in Israel and Palestine, the car bombs on the part of the Palestinians, the military attacks on the part of the Israelis, and what happens then? More car bombs and more military attacks again and again. We've seen the history of responses of the United States to terrorism, you know, as when those American embassies in Kenya and Tanzania were bombed, and Clinton immediately, no questions, no thinking. Well, I don't know. Maybe he's a very fast thinker, you see. But immediately the bombers are sent out to bomb the Sudan, to bomb Afghanistan, you know, and the Sudan. You know, and then it turns out, you probably know this, the plant in the Sudan, which is bombed, they say it's producing chemical weapons. It turns out it was producing medicine for half the population of the Sudan. And thousands of people were deprived of that medicine as a result of that bombing. And what happened? Did that do away? Did that stop the terrorists? They talk about deterrent. Terrorists are not deterred. They're encouraged by violence. They like to see the other side responding the way they did. Ah, now we're in the same game. Violence and violence and violence and violence. So yes, have to look at the roots. And the roots are quite clear. The people who know the Middle East and people who, you know, have interviewed Osama bin Laden and people who Egyptian journalists and Lebanese journalists and Saudi Arabian journalists and people who know the Middle East very well, you know, the correspondent for the Irish, the Dublin Independent, who interviewed Osama bin Laden, who's been there, and they all say the same thing. They're aggrieved by the presence of the troops in Saudi Arabia. They're grieved by the U.S. billions in support of Israel while Israel occupies Palestinian territories. They're aggrieved by the sanctions in Iraq, which have killed hundreds of thousands of people. Those are genuine grievances, and they have to be addressed. And it's up to the American people to insist that they be addressed. Now, you might say, doesn't the government know this? Don't they read these journalists' reports? Don't they read the reports of the interviews with bin Laden? Surely they must know that this, what angers them. Yes, they do know. They don't know a lot. But this they know. Then why don't they do anything about it? Because to do something about that is to ask for a drastic change in American foreign policy. To do that is to say, we are going to withdraw our troops from Saudi Arabia. We're going to stop the sanctions on Iraq. We're going to withdraw our naval vessels from all over the world where they are. We're going to withdraw troops from the many, many, many military bases in many countries all over the world because they're obviously irritants. That's a very mild word. They're bound to cause trouble. Read Chalmers Johnson's book, Blowback, and you'll see, you know, this is a scholar in Asian studies, and he goes instance after instance where the things we do in other countries come back at us. And we've just been lucky up to this now that we haven't had more things come back at us. But the September 11th should be a wake-up call to us, you see. Yeah, the government won't do it because the government doesn't want to change its policy, because the government has its own interests and we have our interests. There is no such thing as a national interest. There's no such thing as national security. You know, there's no such thing as national defense. There's some people's interests and our interests. Some people's defense and our defense. This is not one united country with the same interests. Exxon and I do not have the same interests. You see, no. Their interest is not in withdrawing military forces from around the world. It's just in the interest of the American people and the interest of people elsewhere in the world. But what this means is a very fundamental change in our thinking about the United States. And we may as well start now. That is, we may as well start now talking to our fellow Americans about the necessity for a fundamental change in the role of the United States in the world. Because we have become accustomed since the end of World War II, the United States is a superpower. And accustomed to the idea that the United States must be a superpower. And the question is, and after all, this is the job of a concerned citizen, to ask questions that haven't been asked before, but need to be asked. Why must the United States be a superpower? Or to put it another way, why must we be a military superpower, you see? Why can't we be a humanitarian superpower, you see? No. Why can't we use the immense wealth that we have? I mean, here are millions of people in Afghanistan on the verge of starvation, and we're dropping a few food packets, and we're dropping 100 times as many bombs. Why don't we use our immense resources to help people in other parts of the world who are needy, who need medical supplies, who need food? A portion of the American military budget of $340 billion, a portion of that military budget would solve fundamental problems for a billion people in the world, really. And of course, you know, for us in the United States, it's time that we asked, what are you doing with our national wealth? You know, we don't want our national wealth used this way for destruction. We want our national wealth to be used to make the United States not the feared and disliked nation of the world, but, you know, the respected nation of the world. That's what we want, you see. And if we do that, we could become a more modest nation. Why not be a more modest nation? The modest nations of the world don't worry about terrorism, you know. Sweden and New Zealand and Switzerland and Denmark, they don't worry about terrorism because they're not everywhere in the world with their troops and their planes and their ships. No, they're not bothering anybody. We are bothering people, you see. As always, with serious problems that face the nation, the government is not going to solve it unless people organize, speak up, unafraid of the epithets that are thrown against the dissenters, unafraid of the cries, we demand unity, unafraid of the accusations of you're not patriotic. No, it must be made clear what patriotism is. Patriotism is not support of your government. That's not what patriotism is. Patriotism is support of the people of the United States and of the principles for which the United States is supposed to stand, you see. I want to end. I know, when a speaker says, I want to end, you get very suspicious. They usually don't mean it. You know, say, and in conclusion, and then about an hour later, they're still talking, you see. but I mean this. What does that mean? What is that? Does it? I mean, what do you want me to do? Go into the history of the United States? No. There'll be a period in which, aren't there mics? People can come to mics and ask questions, and right? People already are you already at mics? Is that why you're there? Is this a secret attempt on your part to get freedom of speech? No, what we mean by freedom of speech is a person at the microphone speaks for a long time, you see, and then you are given a minute. If you have questions, if things you want me to talk about, let's say, the 20th century, a little question. What's that? More strategy. Ah, strategy. Yeah. Petroleum. Oh, petroleum. You're embarrassing me. I didn't mention petroleum. I didn't mention oil.
Munitions makers.
Oh. Do I really have to talk about munitions makers? I mean, this is a new way of having a... this is called a town meeting, you see. You all know about oil, right? I mean, you know. You like these, little kids. Tell it again. I like that story. Once more. Again. Yeah. Now, you know that ever since World War II, I mean, that's been the basis of our policy in the Middle East. Ever since World War II, everything we've done in the Middle East has been based on oil. Ever since in 1945, right after the Yalta Conference, Roosevelt met with Ibn Saud, the king of Saudi Arabia, and got together, and they agreed, you see. England is no longer going to be the major force in the Middle East, the major imperial force. The United States is. The American oil companies are going to be the major corporations in the Middle East. And Saudi Arabia, which sits on, you know, half the oil reserves of the world, Saudi Arabia will be protected by the United States and the United States military force, and will be protected against its own people, as we have protected so many dictatorships and monarchies and death squad governments against their own people. And that was the deal that was made. And that still underlies what we've did in Bosnia. It underlies our involvement in the civil war in Greece in 1947. Underlies what we're doing in Afghanistan now. I mean, under Clinton, they were already making plans for the pipeline running from the Caspian Sea, where even larger oil reserves await the oil companies. Pipeline from the Caspian Sea, you know, to the Mediterranean. So, yes, oil. I remember that during the Senate debate just before the Gulf War, before the Senate gave Bush that bush, not the shrub, the bush, you see, but when the Senate was about to give Bush the authority to do whatever he wanted, to use military action in the Middle East. There was a debate, actual debate in the Senate. And I saw that on television. And in the midst of that debate, suddenly these young people in the balcony unfurled this huge banner which said, "No blood for oil." you see. You know how long that lasted. Because we have free speech in the Senate. The security people were there in a flash and whisked it all away, you see, so that people might forget that they saw it. But of course, that's a situation. Blood has been spilled for oil in the Middle East, and blood is being spilled for oil right now and will be again unless the American people begin to organize and speak up against that. So, you know, and when you talk about, you ask about strategy, you know, you ask about strategy as if I really know a lot about strategy. No, you know, there are no miraculous devices, you know, to suddenly bring a great national movement into being. You look at history and you look at how movements came into being and you look at what movements did, and they did all sorts of things. There's no one tactic. They did all sorts of things. They did teach-ins and petitions and demonstrations and civil disobedience and mass rallies and small neighborhood meetings and underground newspapers and community radio stations and did all sorts of things to really inform the American people about what was going on. And it worked during the Vietnam War. Remember, at the beginning of the Vietnam War, two-thirds of the American people were in favor of the war in Vietnam, and a few years later, two-thirds of the American people were against the war in Vietnam. You know, it's a matter of informing and educating and agitating and demonstrating and protesting and persisting and persisting and persisting and understanding that all large movements start very small, with small groups of people here and there around the country. And remember, the media will never tell us about all the people in every part of this country who feel the way we do. All over the country, there are people, millions of people, who feel the way we do, you see. That's important. It's important to understand that. It's important to know that. Hey, didn't I say I was going to conclude with something? Yeah, I was going to conclude by reading a poem, because that, you know, that saves me. That then you know, it's, and because the poets can say things in ways that the rest of us can't. And the poets, and what would we do without the poets? What would we do without the musicians and the theater people or the artists? You know, they're the people who imbue, you know, otherwise solemn political campaigns, you know, with passion and emotion and excitement and spirit. And so I'm going to read a poem by Daniel Berrigan, who is a good friend of mine. All poets are good friends of mine. But he and I became friends when we went to North Vietnam together during the Tet Offensive of 1968, and we've been friends ever since. He was one of the, you know, the great... You know, sometimes... I'm sorry. There were all these, you know, parenthetical remarks which last an hour, you know. And... but I have to say this. Sometimes people say when you sort of... Well, they certainly say it to me, when you take down the traditional heroes, the icons, the founding fathers, Andrew Jackson, Theodore Roosevelt, you take down the racists and imperialists and war makers and power elite, you know, and people say, yeah, but do you realize, you know, you're taking away from the kids need heroes. That's what they say, you know. I said, well, hey, we have lots of heroes. It's just that you're not telling them about the heroes. You're not telling them about the rebels, the farmers of Shays Rebellion. You're not telling them about the Lowell Mill girls who rebelled in the time of Jackson, or the Indians of the Southeast who resisted being removed by the U.S. Army to Western territory. You know, we've had... Here are real heroes throughout, you know, American history. The Wobblies, Mother Jones and Emma Goldman and Big Bill Haywood and Helen Keller and, you know, and, you know, the people who... the people who, yeah. 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 Well, you know, when we take Teddy Roosevelt off Mount Rushmore, I'll be glad to take his place. But all this is a preface to saying, yeah, Daniel Berrigan is one of those people, one of those, you know, yes, people we can inspire young kids with. Yeah, this is how you live your life. Yeah, see, not bowing down to authority, not rushing to the colors and to stay in line, but speaking your mind and doing your thing as you feel a free, freedom-loving person should do. Anyway, he wrote this poem. Maybe some of you heard this poem, but I don't care. Because, you know, as you said, oh, say it again. Okay. But he wrote this poem after a friend of his, Mitchell Snyder, who worked for the homeless in Washington for years and years. Mitchell Snyder became despondent, as anybody might become despondent, working for the homeless and seeing the callousness of the government in relation to people without homes. And he became despondent and took his life, you see. And Dan Berrigan wrote this poem in memory, in loving memory, Mitchell Snyder. Some stood up once and sat down. Some walked a mile and walked away. Some stood up twice, then sat down. I've had it, they said. Some walked 2 miles, then walked away. It's too much, they cried. Some stood and stood and stood. They were taken for fools. They were taken for being taken in. Some walked and walked and walked. They walked the earth. They walked the waters. They walked the air. Why do you stand, they were asked, and why do you walk? Because of the children, they said, and because of the heart, and because of the bread. Because the cause is the heart's beat, and the children born, and the risen bread. Thank you.
That's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening. The Weekly Freak Show is produced in the studios of Freak Radio, 96.3 FM, in Santa Cruz, California, and can also be heard on System P, operating sporadically in Madison, Wisconsin, at 87.9 FM on the far left of your radio dial. The material featured in this program is only a sample of the fine shows each week on Freak Radio. To hear it all, 24 hours a day, listen online at www.microradio.net/FRSC. That's www.microradio.net/FRSC. For questions and comments, send email to FRSC@microradio.net. That's FRSC@microradio.net or snail mail to P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California 95061. That's P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California 95061. Or call us, area code 831-427-4523. That's 831-427-4523. Thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project for distribution. Our theme music was arranged and performed by Neil Norman and his Cosmic Orchestra. For all the folks here at Freak Radio, my name's the V-Man, and that's a wrap.